It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republicans have a chance to win a two-thirds majority in the state Senate and Assembly in tomorrow's elections. That would give them the power to override vetoes, even if Democrats keep the governor's office. We'll look at how likely that is and why northern Wisconsin could play a key role in the outcome. First, Wisconsin is infamous for its drinking culture. While some see it as a badge of honor, it does come with health consequences. But long before old fashions and Wisconsin-made beers became our first choices at a happy hour, cocktails and beer were prescribed to us by health practitioners of various sorts, not bartenders. Alcohol has a long history of attempted medicinal use. Our next guest has a new book that traces back through the history of when beer was expected to treat the flu or brandy could cure malaria, or so people hoped. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of alcohol as medicine? Did you have something like this in your family where a little bit of blank was given you for an upset stomach or whatever, maybe when you were a kid even? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Camper English is a cocktails and spirits writer who has contributed to dozens of publications and runs his own bartending blog called Alcademics. He's the author of the new book, Doctors and Distillers, the remarkable medicinal history of beer, wine, spirits, and cocktails. Camper, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the disclaimer. You say this in your book. You're here writing about the history of attempted uses of alcohol as medicine. You are not prescribing these various cures throughout the millennia.
Absolutely not. Talk to your doctor for medicinal issues. If you want a great drink, that's when you go to your bartender.
Excellent. Okay, now let's go back even to the beginning of alcohol, of beer and wine. It was used as kind of a health supplement because when you started to gather lots of people in civilization, we didn't know how to keep drinking water clean. Can you talk about some of those early uses of our beer and our wine?
Sure. There was a great attempts to avoid drinking water from surface water anyway, from rivers and lakes and streams and things like that, all of which today we know is contaminated from microbes. But back then it was just known to be unhealthy. And so the regular drink for people building the pyramids in Egypt, for example, would be beer. You know, it's made from grain, so it has calories and nutritional aspects to it and some minerals from the fermentation from the yeast. And it was also boiled in the process of making it, very importantly, to kill all those microbes from the water. And when it came to wine, you don't often need to add water in order to ferment wine into its final form. Although the Greeks and the Romans liked to water it down, and they considered full strength wine to be really uncivilized, like taking a swig out of the jug of whiskey today.
And if I'm building a pyramid, I would feel much safer knowing that the people also building the pyramid weren't really drunk. This is pretty low alcohol by volume beer we're talking about, right?
Absolutely. And the grains could be re-fermented a second time. And later in Victorian England and things like that, that was known as small beer and it was probably only 2% ABV or something like that, where the original beer would be still only probably 5% or something. So it wasn't about creating a drunk and docile workforce at all. It was just a healthy, hydrating mineral water of its day.
And you trace from ancient times through medieval and beyond, oftentimes the practice of medicine, such as it was, there was some overlap with the use of alcohol. What stands out to your mind when you think back on what you've written about, you know, how alcohol was used and overlapped with early medicine?
Well, one thing that was a real surprise for me to learn was that distilled alcohol in particular was created only in the context of medicine. There was no beverage use designated for it. It was the alchemist, they'd use distillation to try to create the philosopher's stone to turn lead into gold. And similarly, they would use distillation to preserve things like rose water or wormwood water or things like that with water-based medicine. And once the technology got good enough around the year 1200 or so, we see documentation of like, oh no, if you put wine in the still, this is the greatest medicine ever created. We're going to call it the water of life. It's so good. I always thought that was just a superlative term given to brandy because it's so delicious. But it turns out that was speaking to its revivifying and supposedly health-giving properties of distilled alcohol. And for the next 200 years, people just, that's all they could talk about was, this is really, truly the best medicine ever created. And only later do we find evidence of like, hey, probably don't drink so much medicine all at once because it's not going to create a healthy environment for you.
And this overlap, and I didn't really know about this, in the worlds of alchemy, through the worlds of beer brewing, a lot of things we know in medicine now and in chemistry came from those early alchemy experiments or, oh, hey, if we can control these microbes, we can make better beer. Well, there was some health benefit to figure out about those microbes, too. A lot of our modern health came from this.
Yeah, it's fascinating how the actual study of naturally carbonated water led to the understanding that air wasn't one gas, but was made up of several different elemental gases. And then that led to things like understanding individual elements, as well as later to anesthesia and using gases for other purposes. And then specifically with Louis Pasteur, the study of bacteria in wine and beer led to disproving spontaneous generation and directly to the germ theory of disease, one of the most important concepts in medicine, that there are these invisible microbes that spread disease. And it's not the miasma, the swamp gas that was thought to spread disease between person to person, is actually going to be germs. And then that quickly led to things like anesthetics, antibiotics, and things that kill germ, again, using alcohol as a solution.
Talking to Camper English about his new book, Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Eau Claire. Kathleen, hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. What do you want to tell us about, Kathleen?
Well, my family moved to northern Italy in the early 60s, and at the time, my youngest brother was a baby, was 6 months old. We lived in a hotel for probably 3 or 4 months while my parents were looking for an appropriate place to live. So we had dinner every night in the hotel dining room, in the hotel restaurant, and the baby would be fussy perhaps or crying or something every single night. The waiters would want to give the baby wine. Signora, signora, vino. But no, my mother was not about to do that.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Vino for the Bambino, Camper. You don't need to go all the way to Italy. This happened in my family. I think a lot of people listening at some point in their family history, this happened. And even you talk about patent medicines and things like that. There was a product called gripe water for colicky babies. Kathleen's not alone here.
Yeah, there were actually several advertisements, particularly with Italian bitter liqueurs, where they would be recommended specifically for children. They would even contain iron for extra nutrition back when there were a lot of iron deficiencies. But I would say, you know, a spoonful of this alcoholic herbal medicine, maybe whip it up with an egg for your children every night. And it wasn't just for crying, but to give some medicine to the a daily dose for children. And it's amazing that it was advertised really specifically for that, knowing what we know today.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Steve now on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Three things that from my personal experience. One, my grandmother always said whiskey on the gums of a teething child. Mm-hmm. And you know, we did it and it worked. The other was they're finding a lot of value of flavonoids, and I like hoppy beer. So hops have a lot of flavonoids. So I continue to think that's a medicinal in use. And then finally, the hot toddy, which I swear by when you're not feeling good with a cold.
Steve, thanks a lot. Wow. Steve hit a lot of stuff in your book there, Camper. Take it where you want to go.
Well, sure. In my family, it was you dip the pacifier in whiskey for the teething kid rather than put it directly on their gums. But for hops are not just a flavoring agent for beer, they're a preservative. And it turns out a lot of spices that we know today, they're all antimicrobial and would do the same thing. Wormwood, which we know from absinthe today, was used at one point, just like hops is today, into the beer. It both makes it taste more bitter, but it also would help it last much longer. And so there are a lot of different healing aspects prescribed to these herbs, but I think the hops is really more there and became more common for its preservative qualities overall. And the hot toddy in the era of the global flu epidemic of 1919, formerly known as the Spanish flu, the doctors would report like we couldn't really help, we couldn't do anything for them, but give them a little bit hot toddy to soothe them at the end. Although often we do find bitters in those hot toddies as well, which would have a lot of stomach soothing properties as well.
Thanks for the call, Steve. And Steve is calling from Stoughton, which made me want to talk to you about bitters because I didn't know this. The first big, I guess, English brand name of bitters was Stoughton bitters. And these were totally coming from a world of attempted health treatments, right?
Absolutely. It's Stoughton's bitters in particular, which were patented around the very end of the 1700s in England. Those make their way into the original cocktail, which was not the generic name for all mixed drinks, but a specific one that included dash of medicine in it, Stoughton's bitters. And then that changed forms over the years and became used with other bitters in America. And it was actually a drink meant to soothe the stomach. And it came from the era before ice was common in cocktails. So it was a warm morning hangover drink to soothe the stomach with those medicinal bitters in there. And I can't think of anything less appealing that I would want in the morning.
We're talking to cocktails and spirits writer Camper English about his new book. It's called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard claims about medicinal benefits of alcohol? Do you have that family story of using blank alcohol to cure blank condition? Do you have questions for our guest about his work? He goes back millennia up to the present day on this stuff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, have you ever drunk bitters on a particular bar, on a particular island off the coast of Wisconsin? We'll talk about that coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Camper English, cocktails and spirits writer. His new book is called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Monique is with us in Stevens Point. Monique, hi.
Hi, nice to talk to you guys today.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Monique?
So my son brews mead. Because my husband and I are local beekeepers, and so we provide him with the local organic honey to make mead. And when he started making it and I became such a huge fan, we did a little bit of research into it, and it turns out that mead was one of the original drinks given for people on their honeymoon for helping make babies.
Huh. All right. Monique, thanks for sharing that. A great family story, growing the making the honey and making the mead together. Camper, did you run across a mead-related health claims?
Yeah, there are a few throughout different eras in history because honey, of course, predates sugar as a sweetener in Western Europe and in the United States. And honey in different drinkable forms, particularly with vinegars and things like that, was used for hydrating. And it was also used to cover the bitter flavor, a lot of more medicinal herbs. And so we find it used for a lot of different things over the eras, or just used as an ingredient in them. But even today, there are honey-based burn treatments because honey is very much antibacterial. That's why it can last for so long without spoiling. And it can use to sort of cover or coat and seal up a wound and help recovery in some ways. And that's used in some over-the-counter burn treatments that you can find online.
Monique, thanks a lot for that call. Great story at 800-642-1234. Now, we were talking about bitters earlier. You referenced in the book called Nelson's Hall and Bitters Club on Washington Island here in Wisconsin. People go there to do shots of bitters often. And part of that story happens during Prohibition, where because it was a medicinal use, they got to keep serving booze, even though most places couldn't. This was not uncommon. There was a lot of prescription alcohol out there?
Oh, absolutely. During Prohibition, the ways that people could drink were either by prescription, and then you could go to your pharmacy and just pick up a bottle of whiskey with your prescription, or medicines that had a base of alcohol, whether they were really trying to treat anything or not, could be purchased over the counter, likely without a prescription. So that's where we find things like bitters were fully available to purchase, and that gripe water that you mentioned earlier, these mother's helpers, so to speak, and things of that nature. It's also where we got Jake Leg, which was a horrible condition caused by people drinking an unsafe medicine, which caused a condition where the legs didn't work properly anymore. And that was during the same period with people choosing the medicinal alternatives as a way to get alcohol out of their medicine.
We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, this brings back a lot from the past. Oh, there's so many things. One of them that's really hard to find is Rock and Rye. It was a rye whiskey, and it had big chunks of citrus fruit in the bottle. And when you had a cold, you had that. And we used to have that when we were kids, believe it or not, when you really were congested. You just had a little glass of Rock and Rye.
Gail, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, I had Faygo Rock and Rye soda as a kid. This is something different. You write about the Rock and Rye that Gail's talking about, Camper.
I do. And actually, there was beyond Rock and Rye, there were Rock and Rum and Rock and Gin. And the rock refers to rock candy that was used to sweeten them. And there were also minty herbs in there, like whorehound was a notable herb, along with the citrus. And they were kind of generally feel-good medicines. What it really is, it's an old fashioned all mixed up together, and you can have that hot or cold. But they were to soothe conditions, particularly with the lungs and coughs and cold and consumption, as it was called, that we know it as tuberculosis today, to soothe those issues. And there are still some commercial rock and rye back on the market today.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Camper English about his new book, Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Camper, a story just popped into my head from my life. I can't believe I didn't think of this while I was reading it. I'm 9 years old. I have a sore throat and a cough like I often did when I was a kid. My Polish grandparents are over. I'm coughing, clearing my throat, and my grandpa says what he needs is a hooker. And after the shocked silence, he explains, no, he didn't mean I needed a prostitute. A hooker was what they called. It was slang for a shot that you took to, you know, clear out your throat. Have you run across shots of alcohol for 9-year-olds or otherwise as a sore throat cure?
Well, I got to admit, a lot of times before I give a talk or a Zoom interview, I might moisten my throat with a little bit of whiskey for just that reason.
I'll let my bosses know I do not do that on the air. I don't think the FCC allows that. Camper, I want to spend a little time on a really weird period of American health history. The patent medicines, many of which featured alcohol, plus, heroin and cocaine and strychnine. Talk about some of the alcohol-laced patent medicines we used to have.
Well, sure. So early whiskey was the alcohol of America. And so we find a lot of whiskey-based medicines in particular. For a while, those were homemade remedies that you'd read about in like West Frontier medicine books. But then they became commercialized products that were heavily advertised and, you know, not always safe, often not safe, and often they didn't treat the things that they were advertised to cure. And so we find a lot of quinine, a lot of mercury, and things like that in these patent medicines. Snake oil was a subcategory of patent medicine, and of course that's now the name for fake medicines, but snake oil was a particular type of patent medicine supposedly made with rattlesnakes in America. And it may come from a Chinese tradition, but it wasn't really made with snakes. There was just a real shyster behind the famous snake oil, and he got busted later on. And after 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Law in America took care of actually a lot of the false advertisement in medicine, along with false additives in food and false additives and colorants and alcohol. So those were all wrapped up together in this era of the late 1800s of just garbage medicine, garbage alcohol, and garbage food. And that made its way eventually into what became the FDA.
You mentioned quinine. Now, this is one of the success stories of alcohol and medicine. Quinine, which is in that tonic water, does help with malaria. It's mixed with gin. Why did gin become part of this two-part cure?
Well, I think really the British soldiers were just putting gin in everything as a refreshment. The quinine in the fizzy water comes from the belief that the fizzy water was, in fact, good for you as well. So it was a natural. They put quinine in everything, and it's still in a lot of Italian and French bitter liqueurs on the market today. We only think of it as being in tonic water, but it's in hundreds of products. Alcoholic beverages because of its history treating fevers and malaria in particular. The gin, I think, was really just along for the ride, but the juniper and gin had its own medicinal quantities that it was known for, particularly as a diuretic.
And having gone through the book, Camper, is there a cure you've tried yourself, if I may ask?
I didn't try anything that I haven't tried already, I would say, but I do probably really smart. Sort of believe in digestifs a little bit more than I used to and understand that things like gentian that's in those bitters, you can throw a dash of that in with your fizzy water and it not only tastes great, but it might help, you know, speed the digestion a little bit, make you feel a little bit less full, a little bit faster than you did.
Camper, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Camper English, cocktails and spirits writer and speaker. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Coming up after the news, Republicans in the state legislature are eyeing a potential supermajority and the power to override vetoes, even if there's still a Democratic governor in office. Look at how races in northern Wisconsin could be a key to that outcome, and you can join in with your thoughts and your questions. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the winter holidays are approaching, which often means a lot of social gatherings that include alcohol. Our guest has advice on how to attend those social gatherings with confidence if you're staying sober, and how to host and include people who opt not to drink. Now, tomorrow's elections for governor and U.S. senator have gotten a lot of attention, but changes in the Wisconsin legislature could also have major impacts for state government. Republicans are within reach of winning a two-thirds majority in both houses of the legislature. That would give them the power to override vetoes, from the governor. To win that supermajority, Republicans would need to flip one seat in the state Senate, five in the Assembly. Winning all those races may be a tall order, but some key seats in northwestern Wisconsin stand a good chance of changing hands. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the potential for a veto-proof Republican majority in the state capitol? Have you seen the political mood in your part of the state change in recent years? Have your local district lines changed in a way that could sway the outcome? Do you want to see this supermajority happen, or do you worry about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Epstein is a politics reporter for the New York Times covering campaigns and elections, formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His recent piece focuses on races in northwestern Wisconsin that could be key to Republicans getting closer to that supermajority. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to talk to you again.
Before we look at the possibility of that supermajority, can you talk about what's at stake? How much different could Wisconsin government look with that Republican supermajority?
Well, if the Republicans take two-thirds in both chambers, it really won't matter that much who wins the governor's race. A big feature of Tony Evers' administration over the last 4 years has been his vetoing of 146 bills from the Republicans in the legislature. And if if Republicans take a two-thirds majority or if Tim Michaels is elected, those bills and likely much more will come out of a Republican out of Republican control in Madison. And I think given just how politics has changed in the last couple of years since Donald Trump has been out of office and kind of what it means to be a Republican at this point, I think you would expect to see a much more aggressive posture from those legislative Republicans in Madison than you saw during the Scott Walker years.
And Wisconsin's a state, I think, known in many cases for very close statewide elections. The last couple of presidential elections have been, you know, 1%-ish affairs. Last race for governor, for example, our polls are very close to the race for governor and U.S. Senate here, at least according to the latest polls. How is the legislature so off kilter from that?
Well, if you go, it really goes back to 2010 when Republicans in the Republican wave election during the first President Obama midterm, they won control of the legislature in Wisconsin. Scott Walker was elected governor, and a lot of people remember what came next was the Act 10 fights, where you had tens of thousands of people protesting in Madison. But what got a lot less attention at the time was the new lines that the Republicans implemented for the state legislative districts. And that really allowed Republicans to have a vice grip on majorities in the state legislature. And so that those lines existed for 10 years. And then when there was a new census in 2020 and a new opportunity to draw new lines for the decade that's just starting, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that because the legislature and Governor Evers couldn't agree on the set of maps, that the Supreme Court ordered that the new maps operate under a least change rule from the existing heavily gerrymandered maps. And that gave, you know, Republicans an opportunity to lock in these large majorities in a 50-50 state for another decade. And that's those new maps for the 2020s are what the candidates are running on tomorrow.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Superior. Brian, hi.
Yes, I just want to make a quick point of the fact that, you know, you guys touched on gerrymandering, but I'm kind of afraid of what Michaels came out and said in reference to if he gets in office, there's going to never be another Democrat in office. And what does that mean? More gerrymandering? More corruption? I mean, when there's a two-party system, at least we have a slight chance of checks and balances. And that's my point.
Brian, thanks for the call. Reid, I think you mentioned that particular quote in your reporting. The Michaels campaign has said he means his policies are going to be really good. People won't want to vote for Democrats. Democrats looking at that, as Brian is, though, saying it's in effect a threat that the election landscape could be changed under Republican control.
Yeah, and it's the latest in what's been a pattern with Tim Michaels, where he has said something in public and then his campaign shortly thereafter has had to sort of walk back and say that's not what he really meant. I think what we've had to go by based on other candidates who have sort of been in this position where their campaign has had to sort of do a lot of explaining about what they meant is usually in that case, the candidate means what they say and the campaign is doing some explaining for political expedience.
Brian, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Reid Epstein from the New York Times, looking at the possibility of a Republican supermajority in the state legislature, in which case, in effect, at least when it comes to passing laws, it doesn't matter who would win the governor's race because there'd be a veto-proof majority. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Reid, our caller there, Brian, was from Superior. And this is a part of the state, a northern and northwestern Wisconsin, that you have been focusing on a reporting from. Why is this area so important to this story?
Yeah, I was up there last week in Superior and Ashland and also in Bayfield County as well. It's interesting because those three counties have voted for Democrats in presidential elections in Wisconsin in every election since 1976. They have had Democratic members in the Assembly and the state Senate for even longer than that. It is a part of the state that has a lot of union members, people who worked in paper mills and at the shipyards in Superior and Duluth. And like a lot of rural parts of the country, it has been slipping toward Republicans during the Obama and Trump years, but it still has remained in the Democratic column. That is likely to change in the elections tomorrow, in both, because now both assembly seats and the state Senate seat there, the way they have been redrawn, Donald Trump would have won all three of them. And those are key seats that help get Republicans toward the veto-proof majorities they need in both chambers. Like you said, they need five to flip five seats in the assembly. Two of them are in basically based in Superior and Ashland. The state Senate district covers the northern swath of the state, all the way down to the Twin Cities and over to Rhinelander and Minocqua. And it is a part of the state that that has been Democratic, perhaps, you know, long after it should have been based on the demographics there. But once Democrats lose those seats, they become very difficult to win back. And that's what we have seen in districts that are like this, both in state legislatures and in Congress around the country, that once some of these sort of long-held Democratic areas turn, that the party does not win them back.
And you heard some from both parties on their strategies in the area. You visited with Governor Evers about this issue while he was campaigning in northern Wisconsin. What did he say about the possibility of a Republican supermajority?
Governor Evers was optimistic that they could hold on to veto power, the ability to sustain a veto in the assembly. He said the state Senate would be tougher. The other thing that the governor said was that that if Democrats do lose the ability to sustain the veto, that he expressed some optimism that there would be moderate Republicans that would work with his administration to try to prevent some of the more aggressive Republican proposals from getting through. You know, that I knew when I asked him if he could name some members who he was thinking of, he declined. And so that was hard to know how much of that was wishful thinking or something that, you know, he is telling himself to try to get through the election and not look at the worst case scenario.
And then some Republicans you report in the area are saying, hey, our party's going to control the legislature. You might as well elect somebody locally who's going to be in the majority.
Right. That was the argument from the Republican Party chairman in Douglas County, which includes Superior. He said that, you know, far northwest Wisconsin, it's, you know, 6 hours from Madison. People feel like they're forgotten by the state government up there. And when you have Democrats representing the region in the state legislature, that they seem even more forgotten, because the place where governing is happening and where bills are written are in the Republican conference, and that if the Democrats have very little influence on policymaking in Madison, which he is right about that. Democrats only got hearings on 2% of the bills they introduced this last legislative session. So it's hard to argue with the idea that that if you want a real influence on how state government works and what laws are passed in Wisconsin, that you need to have a voice in the Republican conference rooms.
Let's go back to our callers. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi there. So I have a bit of a loaded question, but if you'll bear with me on this, my first part is, in light of this potential Republican supermajority, I wonder what chance down ballot Dems have of getting elected in the Senate and or Assembly to hold on to the few seats we have and hopefully pick up a couple more. That way we have enough protection against Republican supermajority. And so that's part one. And then part two would be, since we have a state Supreme Court race coming up next year, assuming the liberals take control of the court and take up a case on this last round of redistricting, if that might be able to help Dems potentially pick up some more seats in further elections, I wonder just what the prospects of those trends would entail exactly.
Jack, thanks for the call. I'll refer you to a piece at WPR.org by our own Sean Johnson. Jack, it goes through some of these seats, potential Republican pickups, potential Democratic pickups, and some not odds making, but the giving a scope of the chances. Reed, to Jack's first point, are people thinking of this as a done deal, or is this still legitimately up in the air right now?
I think the Assembly is much more up in the air than the Senate at this point. There's a number of seats that could go either way. It's a much more of a coin flip, and we'll see kind of what the electorate looks like tomorrow, how strong turnout is among both parties, and where turnout is strong too. Because remember, you got to remember, like, a lot of these seats that are competitive are not seats in heavily Democratic areas, right? They're not in Milwaukee. They're not in Dane County. You know, there's a seat in Kenosha that's very competitive. There's another one in Greenfield in the Milwaukee southwest suburbs. There's another one in a couple in the Fox Valley and Beloit. And so that's kind of where this fight over the Assembly supermajority is taking place. The caller's second question is I think, a much bigger sort of atmospheric point here, is that there is a big Supreme Court race that Wisconsin will vote on in April. And if a liberal candidate wins, I've already been hearing Democrats in Wisconsin talking about how quickly they can bring cases to force a new legislative map, to force a change to the state's abortion law that prohibits virtually all abortions in the state. And so those are things that people are sort of fantasizing about doing if they can win the Supreme Court case. But you have to remember, if Republicans are in control, if either Tim Michaels wins or there's a supermajority, Republicans have talked about changing the election law on day one, come January, and it's not out of the realm of possibility that there could be a whole new system of voting if it's passed in January, enacted in time for that April election, that would impact how people vote in that Supreme Court race.
Thanks for that call, Jack. We're talking to New York Times politics reporter Reed Epstein about the potential for a veto-proof Republican majority in the Wisconsin legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hoping this happens? Are you worried it could happen? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Reed Epstein, politics reporter for the New York Times, looking at the possibility of a Republican veto-proof majority in the Wisconsin legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Reed, before we go back to our callers, how unique is Wisconsin in terms of being a fairly evenly politically divided state that has a potential for one party to have this veto-proof supermajority in its legislature?
It's rare, but not unique. In North Carolina, where which is a narrowly divided state, a little more Republican than Democrat, but it has a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper. Republicans need to pick up just a couple of seats in each chamber to be able to override Governor Cooper's vetoes. And then there's a couple of Republican states that have Democratic governors in Kansas, Louisiana, and Kentucky, where all three of those Democratic governors do face veto-proof Republican majorities, but none of those states, and even North Carolina, are not the sort of quadrennial presidential battleground that Wisconsin is, and none of them have quite the same reputation and record of being a 50-50 state as Wisconsin. That's what really makes Wisconsin stand out here, is that it is a state where Democrats have a record of winning statewide elections. In fact, have won 9 out of the last 10 statewide elections. And yet the state legislative map is so tilted toward Republicans that they are on the verge of winning 2/3 of the seats in both chambers.
Let's go back to our callers. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Hey, Jimmy.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I'm hoping when the voters go and poll 11 tomorrow, however they vote, they think about when Walker and the Republicans had the full control, just how much authority they took away from local officials and school districts to fund what they thought locally was a good idea. Everything kind of emanated out of Madison, and that's the complaint that Michaels talks about, turning Madison upside down, whatever that means. And so I think that's what finally undone Walker when he got beat by Evers, is the people local level said, you know, we've had enough of this total control from Madison.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. What do you think, Reed?
Well, that's certainly a big complaint you hear, especially from Milwaukee, Now, the city of Milwaukee is without an infusion of funds from the state government, really is either going to have to make massive cuts to its services, particularly its police department in the next couple of years, or it's going to wind up declaring bankruptcy. And that's a real fiscal ticking time bomb that's happening for the city and the state. And the Republicans who control the state legislature in Madison have not shown any real inclination to help solve that problem up to this point.
Thanks for the call. Harry joins us now in Rock Falls. Harry, hello.
Hello. My question is, what with Trump endorsing the write-in candidate in Robin Voss's district, do you think that that might split the Republican vote and that actually the Democrat might win that district?
Harry, thanks for the call. I don't think there is actually a Democrat on the ballot. There's another write-in candidate. A tall order, even with a Donald Trump endorsement read for a write-in candidate to overturn an incumbent like Robin Voss.
Yeah, you know, we've seen a lot of wacky things in the last few years during the Trump era. And you remember Robin Voss almost lost the primary to Adam Steen, who's challenged him in the primary, now is running as a write-in candidate and has Trump's endorsement. But I guess I wouldn't bet too expensive a meal on that race, on Robin Voss being in a whole lot of trouble in that race.
Thanks for the call, Harry. Another thing you focus on in your piece, Reed, based on your reporting here in Wisconsin, the idea we hear again and again that more and more elections, even at the state or even local level, are still national issue elections. How much of a factor is that? We're focusing maybe more on big nationwide stuff instead of our local and state politics.
I mean, I think it's a big issue. You know, you think about the difference between now and even 10 or 15 years ago, how many people that don't get any, you know, don't get a local newspaper or don't have local radio stations because corporate ownership of those has, you know, cut away at the number of reporters that are available. You know, in Wisconsin, we've seen Gannett, the Gannett company, buy up most of the local daily newspapers and centralize the reporting and cut the number of journalists that exist in a lot of these communities. And so that's meant that there is just happens to be less news being reported in these places. And at the same time, people are getting more and more of their news from social media, which, you know, we know about how people get siloed into their sort of political areas on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere, and on cable news. People are watching Fox News. They're getting their, you know, broad Fox News or MSNBC or even CNN. They're getting broad swaths about national parties and less information about what's happening locally. And that, for a lot of these Democrats in rural areas, they have told me that it really makes it difficult for them to explain that they're different from Joe Biden, whose approval rating is subterranean at this point. And it makes it so that they do a lot of explaining about what they're not and less about what they're for.
And you wrote it for some of these districts, especially those key districts in northern Wisconsin, maybe having to drive a couple few hours to do the local TV or newspaper interview.
That's right. And, you know, the newspapers in Superior and Ashland come out just a couple times a week. They have one or maybe two full-time reporters. They're in a TV market. The state Senate district cuts across TV markets in Wausau, Duluth, and Minneapolis. And so there's not going to be any attention paid to that from the local television stations. And it's frankly very expensive to get a message out. And so when the combination of all those things happening and the low news environment leads voters into their partisan corners.
Reed, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thank you. Happy to be on.
That's Reed Epstein, politics reporter for the New York Times, now formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us about the possibility of Republicans winning a veto-proof majority in the Wisconsin legislature. Republicans would need to flip one seat in the state Senate and five in the Assembly in order to make that happen. Speaking of elections, voting day is tomorrow, and you can follow the results here on the Ideas Network. That's starting at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Could be a long, slow process. They often are, but you can keep up with the latest developments tomorrow night here on the Ideas Network, or you can listen live online at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. If you are looking to buy or sell a house or get a new mortgage, things have changed a lot over the course of the last year. Find out what's going on, get some advice, and maybe get some answers to your own questions if you call or email in. That's Mortgage and House Buying Talk tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. If you like seeing cool things in the night sky, I've got good news and bad news for you. Good news, overnight, Wisconsin can see a total lunar eclipse. That's the one where the moon is in Earth's shadow, and it looks cool. Bad news, as reported by NASA, the process starts just after 2 a.m. The full eclipse starts at about 4:15 a.m., with maximum coverage around 5 a.m. I'm pulled in both directions here. On the one hand, I'm a fan of lunar eclipses, really enjoyed the last couple I've seen. On the other hand, I am a fan of sleeping, and this all happens at a time when I'm usually sleeping. So I have to decide if I'm going to try to stay up all night for it or set my alarm super early. Partly cloudy tonight, that's an upside. Downside low of 35, and it's going to be the last total lunar eclipse until 2015. I'll have this debate with myself during the day. If you end up watching it, let us know. Email your description, pictures if any, to ideas@wpr.org. Nothing I could say, a total eclipse of the moon. This is Central Time.